You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a New York Times CBS poll published last March, President Obama's job approval rating had dropped to a low of 41%, which was a 9-point decrease in just 1 month. In an election year where the economy, our presence in Afghanistan, and talk of a possible Israeli attack on Iran have become major issues, President Obama, or any president for that matter, would feel pressure from all sides of the political spectrum. From the outset, his swift and historic ascent to the presidency made him a prime target of attacks from the right, but now, after 3 years in office, criticism has been growing from the constituency that put him into the White House. Gary Dorian, the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and a professor of religion at Columbia University, has taken a look at the progressive electorate's increasing disappointment in what they perceive to be the president's betrayal of the causes he championed in 2008 in a book he has called The Obama Question, A Progressive Perspective. He visited our show in March, and it provoked a lot of response from listeners, so we thought we would re-air it for you on this holiday week. I began by asking Gary Dorian to clear up something. Is there a difference between progressive and liberal?
No, the terms go back and forth. We're in a mode right now when progressive is more favored than liberal. Liberal has connotations that have become less savory to a certain spectrum of the public. And so there's a kind of cyclical pattern over the past century where one term gets favored over the other.
So if you keep on complaining about people being too liberal, then you just simply say, well, I'm a progressive.
It's something like that, yeah.
How large is the progressive constituency today, and who makes it up?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, people self-identify in this country as about 20% either liberal or progressive, and about 30% or upwards of 35% conservative, and then about 40% moderate. So you always have questions. Anytime someone who somewhat identifies, or at least in a leaning way, identifies with the progressive side, whether, you know, how liberal any administration can be in a country that self-identifies in that way.
Well, we talk a lot about how the conservative constituency breaks up into different little things. There's the Tea Party group, and then there are the social conservatives, there are the evangelical conservatives. Do we see the same sort of thing on the left?
That's certainly true, and it was true during the campaign. There are folks now who are expressing enormous disappointment or anger that Obama isn't as progressive as he claimed to be during the campaign. I don't think that's true. I think that he has governed in pretty much the manner that he promised to do. But that the complaint itself does reveal, it shows that there are different tendencies among folks on the progressive side to begin with.
Were they just reading what they wanted to read into him?
A number of people, that is the case. I mean, some folks are just forgetting that when they helped him get elected, they spent most of that time complaining that he didn't have a single radical position in his entire portfolio. And indeed, that was true. I mean, the only position he had that was sort of risky in terms of national politics was his opposition to the war in Iraq. And of course, by the time that he ran, that position played to his favor in the Democratic weeding out process. And of course, he had committed himself to that one long before he was a national figure. So that was the only issue in which he had a position that progressives could look at and say, yes, there's one of ours.
But we've been hearing from progressives concerns that although he offered himself in opposition to most of the Bush policies, he's pretty much maintained some of them, maybe eliminated torture and some other things, but hasn't changed it as much as people might have expected, considering what he was saying on the campaign trail.
No, and that's what has upset progressives so much, and I'm one of them. In fact, how I came to write this book, I was writing a big book on Kant and Hegel a little over a year ago and expecting to finish it. I wasn't in a hurry to finish it, but I keep hearing over and over on the lecture circuit people saying to me, I worked hard for him last time, and I won't lift a finger for him again. I am so finished with him. He has betrayed us, and so on. And people often say this sort of thing to me because I've been known for criticizing Obama since virtually the day he started announcing appointments.
Although this book, to some degree, is a defense of Obama. I read in today's Times that George Soros is unlikely to give big money to any Obama PAC, which would suggest that some of the people he would hope to help him might sit this one out.
That's true. That registers across a quite wide spectrum of the left, of progressives, among liberals, and so on. And it started right away. I mean, he began the first important decision that he made was to appoint his Treasury Secretary and then his top economic advisor. And who does he pick but the two Democratic officials most closely associated with Wall Street and decisions that broke down the wall between commercial and investment banking and cut the bailout deals for the banks and then helped the banks facilitate their mergers so they became even bigger than ever. And all of that, and that's before the Obama administration has even begun, that already registered just enormous disappointment. And we've been living with a fair amount of the downside from that ever since.
And I've been hearing from people from the left that they kind of expected him to at least name either Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman to his economic team. He didn't name either of them.
Certainly. People like Cornel West.
Did he see them as too far left?
Yes. People like Cornel West, who did 65 events for Obama when he ran, did hope to see somebody like, you know, a sort of down the middle liberal Keynesian type of some, you know, prestige, someone like Stiglitz or Krugman, or at least someone who's not as famous as those two are, but at least have politics that aren't so closely tied to Wall Street. That was the expectation. So there was enormous disappointment.
Summers and Geithner have turned out to have constant battles with each other, that could have been predicted. Shouldn't he have been aware of their different economic philosophies, or did he like the idea that they wouldn't agree?
Well, firstly, Summers coming in said, I'm willing to tell you about what others think, but I'm not going to be a neutral broker of many views, which had been the traditional role of that position that he took. Obama said, that's fine. I don't need a broker. I can be my own broker. Brokering is my specialty. And so that was the sort of the dynamic of those first couple of years. And Summers himself really made no proposals in those first 2 years. Other people would make proposals, and then he'd tear them apart and show why that didn't work. He did do some heavy lifting on getting the stimulus through. And, in fact, he thought the stimulus needed to be bigger, and he said it. They got as big.
Whereas Geithner argued that we had to cut the deficit, and they represented two poles.
That's right. And Geithner at least did make proposals. That plan to sort of try to buy up the toxic assets of the banks, which he called the aggregator bank, it was sort of a variant on the bad bank model. That was Geithner's proposal. One thing after another. I mean, the mode was Geithner at least trying to do something. Some are saying, well, watch out for the unanticipated consequences of whatever that would be. And so you had 2 years of just of what Obama himself called relitigating the same issues over and over, and not a whole lot got done.
Well, this has gotten him flack from left and right, the way the banks were handled. Just so Pat Robertson has now complained that nobody has been indicted for what happened during the economic what we want to call a debacle.
Yeah. Obama had barely been in office for 6 weeks. He meets with the heads of all the big banks, and he says to them, I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks. That was a moment when he could have reduced the size of the banks. It would have been tremendously popular. There were Republican votes for cutting down the mega banks. And instead, he says to them, we're all in this together. We need to act that way. And they all nodded in fake agreement and said, oh, yeah, we're all in this together. And that group got more together and formed the CDS Dealers Consortium. And they lobbied against every single thing in the Dodd-Frank bill. And then after a few things got through, they've been spending $50 million per quarter ever since to get rid of what did get through.
As we approach the next presidential election, for many of us, it's a good time to reassess our candidates' performances. And today we're discussing President Obama's performance in his first term with theologian and social activist Gary Dorian. He has written a book called The Obama Question. I wonder whether we should be surprised. You said that we misread him earlier. He sees Ronald Reagan as the president to measure himself against.
Yes. Reagan he sees as a kind of forward-looking optimist who made a huge impact on history, that it's a transformational presidency, that in effect we're still living in the Reagan era. And Obama wanted to have a similar kind of impact, not in the way Reagan did. I mean, Reagan is the one who led us into temptation, thinking that tax cuts pay for themselves, so don't worry about the debt. And so it certainly isn't with Reagan's politics, but he does respect Reagan and holds him up in some ways as a kind of model of what kind of presidency he wants to have, only differently.
Well, Reagan was a great communicator, and it was assumed that Barack Obama would be a great communicator because during the campaign and earlier, he had been such a forceful speaker, and then people started complaining that that man seemed to disappear, and Time magazine recently listed him among the introverted presidents as opposed to George Bush or Bill Clinton.
Yes. Reagan would stand and fight on things that he thought were important enough to fight about and maybe lose on, and that is what progressives have been waiting for from Obama, just on some major thing, to plant the flag somewhere and work hard to get a different outcome than the one that's right before you, instead of taking the half loaf that's right there to take, to stand and fight on something that is worth fighting for and also worth risking legislative defeat for. There's not a single issue among the whatever half dozen big ones that you could look at and say, yeah, he did it there. No, there was always this, you start by him sort of negotiating with himself and then indicating his willingness to take whatever half loaf is out there and whatever he might be able to get the 60th vote in the Senate on without having to twist arms or fight in public about it. That's what we've always ended up with in his term, and that is what has been really exasperating for progressives.
Didn't he see from the start that this was not going to be typical? Most presidents are given a honeymoon, and he was given none. Mitch McConnell came out and said right at the start that his goal was to prevent Obama from becoming the president reelected in 2010. Was he not listening?
Yeah, this is enormously important. I think that he's a likable type who convinced independents that he could get the two sides of the House to work together, that he had done it his whole career. And in fact, this kind of appeal is what had always worked for him his entire career. He has an electrifying impact when he first becomes a national figure in 2004 at the Democratic Convention, giving that speech about, we're not red and blue, we're the United States of America and all that. So that wasn't just the shtick. I mean, that is Obama himself, and that is what has always worked for him. So I think he did enter the White House thinking that he can do that, that he would be able to pull the country together, and it stunned him. He just was not prepared at all for a very modest Keynesian stimulus in the context of an economy that is in a freefall crash where we've just lost 3 million jobs last year and are just lost 741,000 in January alone. And he's got this very modest stimulus package in play, and he can't get a single Republican vote out of the House for that. He was astonished.
Well, was there an organized campaign? For example, you get the feeling that the last two presidents were Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, that the 8 years of the Bush presidency have kind of disappeared. That the deficits, when Democrats bring up the fact that the deficits grew hugely during the Bush years, that kind of talk is just dismissed.
Well, we're about to have an election, I think, over this very thing. Are we really going to go back to the policies that got us in this fix that we're in? The irony is that there's so much screaming about the debt on the Republican side, and yet it's Republican policies that created this explosion in the debt. If we had stuck with the Clinton tax policies, we wouldn't have this debt. And then, of course, Bush's tax policies immediately blew a $2 trillion hole in the deficit, and he launched two wars that we didn't pay for either, and then a prescription drug benefit that we didn't pay for, the first entitlement in American history that doesn't have a revenue source. And that's what created this explosion of debt that now is somehow Obama's fault or his problem to deal with. In the meantime, we have this enormous crash, and the only way to get out of it is to try to stimulate your way out. And yes, that does increase the debt, but that's what you have to do in the kind of context we're in now.
My guest is Gary Dorian, Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and Professor of Religion at Columbia University. He has written 15 previous books, mostly on social theory and ethics and philosophy, and also a bit on politics. And the latest is definitely about politics. It's called The Obama Question, A Progressive Perspective. It's published by Roman and Littlefield. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had with Gary Dorian in March, in which we discussed his 16th book, The Obama Question, A Progressive Perspective. I began the second half of our conversation by returning to the stimulus package that President Obama had championed right after taking office and that many people felt was inadequate to solve the problems of the economy. I pointed out it can be argued that it's a good idea to propose something right away, striking while the iron is hot during a time when there's a real sense of crisis. And I asked Gary Dorian, why do you think so many people felt the stimulus package was weak? Did the president think that this was the only way he could get it through?
Well, yes, his own staff, when they met in December, the month before he's inaugurated, talked about how much do we need. And Summers and Christina Romer both agreed, you can't spend too much. I mean, there's just no way in this context that you could ever pour on too much Keynesian gas in the context of this calamity that we're in. I mean, we're in the right in the middle of just a free-falling crash, and it was hard to even get anything like reliable numbers. In fact, they ended up erring a little too much on the conservative side when they did, which they've been paying for ever since. So it was strictly a political calculation, is how much do you think we could get? Summers and Romer both said, oh, we need at least $1.2 trillion. But then when the discussion turned political, how much are we likely to be able to get out of this Congress, everyone agreed that $1 trillion would be the absolute maximal figure, and we probably can't get that much out of 60 votes in the Senate. So 787 was what they thought they could get. It was a political calculus.
A listener posted a question on our show page. The mystery for me, he writes, is Obama indeed left at heart but acts moderate in order to appease, or were his inner principles in fact moderate to begin with?
Well, he gives speeches, and he has a certain sensibility that certainly seems and feels progressive, and the way that he refers to the civil rights movement and holding King up as his hero, especially in certain major speeches that he's given. I mean, you always know he's going to end there. He's going to go there when he gets the Nobel Prize or similar kinds of occasions. So all that smacks of a certain, on a feeling level, that Obama is sort of like us if you're a progressive. And yet if you look at the policy sections of anything he's ever written and what he says about himself, he's insistent. He has always been. He hasn't tried to get us about this, that he's in the middle of American politics. He is trying to hold together the two wings.
And yet he's constantly attacked for being a socialist.
Well, indeed, that's the absurdity of this Tea Party position, that we don't need a stimulus. He's forcing this stimulus on us, coming right out of the box. And indeed, he wanted to sign that bill on his first day in office. They ended up deciding, well, since we don't even have offices ourselves in January, it's probably going to take a few weeks. So, yeah, it took a month to get that stimulus bill through. But they were so detached from the reality we're living through that they're treating this rather mild stimulus, considering the circumstance, is something that's radical and socialist and anti-American.
But
and so
is this something that any Democrat has to face? I remember when Bill Clinton was elected and I started reading letters in the Wall Street Journal calling him a Marxist, and the kindest was that he was a McGovern Democrat. Well, Bill Clinton was nothing of the sort. He was probably no more to the left than Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So in the case of Obama, does it also matter that he's black?
It's true that this president has reignited the same right-wing noise machine that accused Clinton of treachery and murder and drug running and so on. And I think it's also true that to some degree, in some ways, The things that the right has made up about this president are not as bad as the criminality fantasies that it made up about Clinton.
They just say he's a Muslim or that he was unconstitutionally elected because his father was not an American citizen.
Yeah, you know, this is the part of it. When I decided to write this book,
birth certificate?
I didn't have to. I mean, I was ready to write the policy sections right away. But the part that I wasn't quite ready for, I'd merely sort of tasted that conspiratorial literature that's out there about him. So that's what I had to get worked up to speed on and read a whole stack of these best-selling books and read them in sequence in the form that they had been written in. And I was astonished. You couldn't possibly exaggerate the venom, the just sheer hatred that pulsates through these right-wing blogs and the conspiracy books and the like. And, of course, this started, it started before the beginning. It heated up some campaigns at the end of the 2008 campaign because some of this literature was already out there. And he had barely been inaugurated president. We had folks in rallies out there saying, you know, marching around saying, I want my country back. And they've got a placard of America's first black president pictured just in case anybody needs an interpretation.
So it's not a matter of hating his policies, but hating him simply because he's black, because he's young?
There are upwards of tens of millions of Americans
Hawaiian?
For whom he's just... he's simply illegitimate. They have an alternative story on every part of his life and career to tell. It's always about he is this seething alien anti-American radical who is out to subvert America.
Now, when I had two founders of a Tea Party group on the show, I asked them whether they were concerned about the growing debt during the Bush administration, or did it only occur to them that there was a problem when Barack Obama became president? And they said, well, we were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But the protests seem to occur only after Barack Obama entered the White House.
Yes, and over three quarters of the debt that's accumulated on Obama's watch is directly the result of Bush's policies, and then most of the rest is just cleanup for the financial crash.
My guest is Gary Dorrien, D-O-R-R-I-E-N, of Columbia University and of the Union Theological Seminary. His latest book, The Obama Question, A Progressive Perspective, published by Roman and Littlefield. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Obama credits theologian Reinhold Niebuhr as a major influence, and you're the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary. What ideology did Niebuhr follow that that Obama admires so much?
Well, Reinhold Niebuhr was a liberal Democrat. Of course, in his time, that put him at the center of American politics, what Arthur Schlesinger called the vital center. He was a theorist of what he called Christian realism. And so what Niebuhr's famous for several things, but what is always going on in his work is he is trying to hold together Christian ethics and a realistic sort of under what he calls a realistic understanding of politics, that politics is always about a struggle for power. And so what's always going on in any Niebuhr book is trying to sort of hold together the belief in a moral law that transcends our interests and that in his case has a Christian inspiration and a real sort of hardcore power politics understanding of what's going on in our public world.
Well, isn't that what we're seeing today, an invocation of Christian morality and power politics at the same time, but from the people who are running for the Republican nomination?
Yes. This is one limitation about sort of drawing upon Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr could not have imagined this life world that we have now. I mean, in his time, mainline Protestantism called itself that without any kind of irony or the like. I mean, it is in the sort of center of American culture. He takes for granted that the churches have modernized, that they've accepted the historical critical approach to the Bible and so on. So for Niebuhr, in his time in the 40s and 50s and really through the 60s, he just does not have any understanding that what had been the fundamentalist churches are going to rise to some kind of political power. So that any sort of analysis about what we've deal with all the time now, that is the rise of the Christian right as a frankly and explicitly politicized entity in our politics, you can't get much analysis of any of that out of Reinhold Niebuhr.
When Barack Obama spoke at the Democratic National Convention in 2004, you point out that Chicago Tribune columnist wrote about his speech, quote, "We should not reward his blockbuster performance at the DNC by loading his shoulders with the fate of the nation. Not yet, anyway. That can wait, perhaps, until, say, his 2012 presidential campaign."
Yes.
So did he just win too early? Was he not ready?
That was Clarence Page who wrote that. And he did end up running much sooner than even he expected. I mean, he always expected to run. He was drawing enormous crowds of mostly white, liberal and moderate audiences wherever he went. And this thing just came along. It built up much faster than anything he could have expected. And then people like Harry Reid are pulling him aside and saying, you know, you're not going to get to choose when this happens. It's happening now. And so stop worrying about whether it's come too fast. You're kind of bored with the Senate anyway. It's got a languid pace, and you're a big thinking type who's anxious to make something happen. And it's actually going to be an advantage if you run now. You don't have that many votes to defend. It's just harder later on when there's more to have to defend. So stop worrying about that. Your time has come already. You might as well go for it. People like Harry Reid had a big impact on him. It was hard to deny the truth of what they were saying politically. It was just such a fantastic groundswell that we ended up with. It ended up being kind of a shortcut in more than one way.
Why do you think he chose to tackle something as difficult as health care so early in his presidency? Had he forgotten what happened during the debate over the health care bill that Hillary Clinton and Ira Magaziner had put together just a few years before?
Well, there are a couple of ironies about that. One is that health care had not been one of his top concerns when he campaigned. He didn't speak about it with the kind of passion that Hillary Clinton did, or even John Edwards. And it was only as the campaign wore on, and he's talking to people who've lost their health care because they lost their job, or they talk to someone, he's talking to people who've, someone's died in their family because they lost their health care, or they were excluded because of some pre-existing condition. And of course, during the weeding out process, he was against the mandate. And yet, as the campaign wore on, he more and more it got into his stump speech, and he's speaking with more passion about it. By the time he was running against campaign, he's running against McCain, he's speaking about it passionately every day. And I think this is a genuine case of feeling something more deeply and passionately by the end of a campaign, just by meeting ordinary people who've been affected by our healthcare system, that he was passionate about it by the time he's elected. And all that legacy of seven presidential failures before him, that's what elevated, that's helped to elevate it as a priority in his head, because he wants to have an historic transformational presidency.
But then he became open to attack on both left and right. The right has labeled it Obamacare, and everything is wrong. The left was upset that the public option was left out.
I think that's another irony about it. Here he is only a month into his presidency, and he's willing to risk the entire thing on something that he didn't even care that much about until just a few months ago. And his whole staff, except for Melody Barnes, one person, a former Kennedy staffer, is the only one who's saying, yeah, let's do health care next. He's willing to risk everything on the for this cause. And yet then he goes about it in an opportunistic way that is very, very hard for progressives to swallow. He ends up virtually advertising from the outset that he's willing to take half a loaf on it. So he's not willing to put something out there that he's willing to sort of fight for, and that's bottom line for him. So the very way that he went about getting something through is just almost calculated to demoralize the very people who cared most about it.
What about foreign policy? Most of the critics of his approach to foreign policy have been from the left until recently. Now, because of Iran, we have the Republican candidates going after him as well. Do progressives feel that Obama has lived up to his foreign policy commitments? Hasn't he been criticized for the way Osama bin Laden and Anwar al-Awlaki were killed?
Yes and no again. Right out of the box, he did sign a statement against we weren't going to torture people anymore, and he was going to try to shut down Guantanamo. He committed himself to a timeline on that one. Of course, he ended up caving on that one, but he did fight it for a couple of years. He did get us out of Iraq exactly as he promised, pretty much on the timeline that he promised. At the same time, it was also a campaign promise that he was going to escalate in Afghanistan, and of course, he did that right away. We were always upset about that, tried to influence him about it. Tried to argue that that is an option that has sinkhole written all over it. It's Lyndon Johnson doubling down in Vietnam and Mikhail Gorbachev doubling down in Afghanistan all over again, and we'll end up with a similar result. But he did press to a different conclusion because he'd campaigned on it. And of course, in the end, he ended up tripling down in Afghanistan, and I think that's not playing out well.
And, well, when you have the kinds of things that just happened recently undermining any policy, it's really hard to succeed in a place like Afghanistan. Do you feel that the debt ceiling debate changed the way Obama negotiates? Did it toughen him in some ways?
I think it has. I think that he has been a noticeably different figure on the stump, just the feeling that he communicates, a certain sort of passion, a sort of back in his appearances. He's focused now on knowing what is the rest of his presidency and hopefully a second term sort of needs to be about, that we need massive investments to build a clean energy economy. And he says that every week now. And I think that he does realize that his sort of dream of being the likable one who gets Republicans and Democrats to agree on his concept of good government just was not playing out, and he needs to stand and fight for something.
Some people have argued that it doesn't matter what he does. The Republican candidates have been so self-destructive that he will just be seen as the only reasonable alternative. But is it possible that a Mitt Romney or a Rick Santorum might be our next president?
Oh, it's certainly possible. You know, the Republican Party has enormous advantages just going in. There are a number of states that are just automatically Republican, and they're the very ones that Romney's having trouble in right now. But he's going to win all of those states if he's the nominee. Whereas the Democrats, even the states that, you know, they should win, they have to work for them. It is always uphill for a Democrat in a presidential election.
Priya on Facebook asked our last question, why aren't we seeing someone from the left organize a presidential run if Obama is so unpopular with progressives? Would they be open to the same kind of criticism Ralph Nader was open to?
Definitely. That there are a number of the same folks who organized or are calling for a different campaign in 2000 and who ended up backing Ralph Nader are saying similar things today, but at least it's in their own recent memory. Well, we do bear a certain guilt for how that turned out. And if it's close enough, which it could be, we could have a similar result to we had in 2000. And so the Gore presidency that should have been didn't occur. And instead, we invaded Iraq and we gave tax cuts to the rich and we doubled the debt and with consequences that we're paying for dearly. Now.
Do you think progressives will be holding out on their voting, sitting out this election? Young people who also were mobilized during the first campaign?
I don't think it's so much a voting issue as it is an issue about whether you'll get the same sort of critical mass that's willing to take a sabbatical or leave your job or make an arrangement so that thereby you can get out there and work hard for him.
Gary Durian's latest book, his 16th, is The Obama Question, a Progressive Perspective, published by Roman and Littlefield. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Leonard.